Officers carried stacks of blank FI cards on their person or in their patrol cars. Ballard had always kept hers under the sun visor in her car when she had worked patrol in Pacific Division. At the end of a shift, the cards were turned in to the divisional watch commander, and the information on them was entered by clerical staff into a searchable database. Should a name that was run through the database produce a match, the inquiring officer or detective would have a ready set of facts, addresses, and known associates to start with. The American Civil Liberties Union had long protested the department's use of the cards and the collection of information from citizens who had not committed crimes, calling the practice unlawful search and seizure, and routinely referring to the Q&As as shakedowns. The department had fended off all legal attempts to stop the practice, and many of the rank and file referred to the 3x5 cards as shake cards, a not-so-subtle dig at the ACLU. "Why were they keeping them?" Ballard asked. "Everything was put into the database and would be easier to find there."
"I don't know," Rivera said. "They didn't do it that way at Hollenbeck."
"So what did you do? Clear them out?"
"Yeah. Me and Sandy emptied the drawers."
"You threw them all out?"
"No. If I've learned anything in this department, it's not to be the guy who fucks up. We boxed them and took them to storage. Let it be somebody else's problem."
"What storage?"
"Across the lot."
Ballard nodded. She knew he meant the structure at the south end of the station's parking lot. It was a single-level building that had once been a city utilities office, but had been turned over to the station when more space was needed. The building was largely unused now. A gym for officers' use and a padded martial arts studio had been set up in two of the larger rooms, but the smaller offices were empty or used for non-evidentiary storage. "So this was 7 years ago?" she asked.
"More or less," Rivera said. "We didn't move it all at once. I cleared one drawer out, and when it got filled and I had to go down to the next, I'd clear that one. It went like that. Took about a year."
"So what makes you think that Bosch was looking for shake cards last night?" Rivera shrugged.
"There would have been shake cards in there from the time of the murder you're talking about, right?"
"But the info on the shake cards is in the database."
"Supposedly. But what do you put in the search window?
See what I mean? There's a flaw.
If you wanted to see who was hanging around Hollywood at the time of the murder, how do you search the database for that?"
Ballard nodded in agreement, but knew that there were many ways to pull up info on field interviews in the database, such as by geography and time frame. She thought Rivera was wrong about that, but probably right about Bosch. He was an old-school detective. He wanted to look through the shakes to see who the street cops in Hollywood were talking to at the time of the Clayton murder.
"Well," she said, "I'm out of here. Have a good one. Stay safe."
"Yeah, you too, Ballard," Rivera said.
Ballard left the detective bureau and went up to the women's locker room on the second floor. She changed out of her suit and into her sweats. Her plan was to head out to Venice, drop off laundry, pick up her dog at the overnight kennel, and then carry her tent and a paddleboard out to the beach. In the afternoon, after she had rested and considered her approach, she'd deal with Bosch. The morning sun blistered her eyes as she crossed the parking lot behind the station. She popped the locks on her van and threw her crumpled suit onto the passenger seat. She then saw the old utilities building at the south end of the lot and changed her mind about leaving right away. She used her key card to enter the building and found a couple other denizens of the late show working out before heading home after the morning rush hour. She threw a mock salute at them and went down a hallway that led to former city offices, now used for storage. The first room she checked contained items recovered in one of her own cases. The year before, she had taken down a burglar who had filled a motel room with property from the homes he had broken into, or had bought with the money and credit cards he had stolen. Now, a year later, the case had been adjudicated, and much of the property had still not been claimed. It had been returned to Hollywood Station for when the division organized an annual open house for victims as a last chance for them to claim their property. The next room down was stacked with cardboard boxes containing old case files that, for various reasons, had to be kept. Ballard looked around here and moved several boxes in order to get to others. Soon enough, she opened a dusty box that was filled with FI cards. She had hit pay dirt. 20 minutes later, she had culled 12 boxes of FI cards and lined them along the wall in the hallway. By individually sampling cards from each of the boxes, she was able to determine that the cards spanned the years from 2006, when the digitizing initiative began, to 2010, when the homicide section was moved out of Hollywood Division. Ballard estimated that each of the boxes held up to 1,000 cards. It would take many hours to comb through them all thoroughly. She wondered if that was what Bosch was expecting to do, or if he was planning a more precise search for one card, or one night in particular, perhaps the night Daisy Clayton was taken off the street. Ballard wouldn't know the answer until she asked Bosch. She left a note on the row of boxes in the hallway, saying that they were on hold for her. She returned to the parking lot and got into her van after checking the straps, holding her boards to the roof racks. Shortly after she had been assigned to Hollywood Division, and word leaked that she was involved in an internal harassment investigation, there were some in the station who attempted to retaliate against her. Sometimes it was basic bullying, sometimes it went deeper. One morning, at the end of her shift, when she stopped her van at the station lot's electric gate, her paddleboard slid forward off the roof and crashed against the gate, splintering the nose's fiberglass. She repaired the board herself and started checking the rack straps every morning after her shift. She took La Brea down to the 10 freeway and headed west toward the beach. She waited until a few minutes after 8 o'clock to call the number for RHD that she still had programmed into her phone. A clerk answered, and Ballard asked for Lucy Soto. She said the name with a clipped familiarity that imparted the idea that this was a cop-to-cop call. The transfer was made without question. "This is Detective Soto." "This is Detective Ballard, Hollywood Division." There was a pause before Soto responded. "I know who you are," she said. "How can I help you, Detective Ballard?" Ballard was used to detectives she wasn't personally acquainted with knowing about her. With female detectives, there was always an awkward moment. They either admired Ballard for her perseverance in the department or believed her actions had made their own jobs more difficult. Ballard always had to find out which it was, and Soto's opener gave no hint as to which camp she was in. Her repeating Ballard's name out loud might have been a move to let someone like a partner or supervisor on the task force know who she was talking to. Not being able to read her yet, Ballard just pressed on. "I work the late show here," she said. "Some nights it keeps me running, some nights not so much. My LT likes me to have a hobby case to kind of keep me busy." "I don't understand," Soto said. "What's this have to do with me? I'm sort of in the middle of..." "Yeah, I know you're busy. You're on the harassment task force. That's why I'm calling. One of your cold cases, that you're not working because of the task force, I was wondering if I could take a whack at it." "Which case?" "Daisy Clayton. 15-year-old murdered up here in..." "I know the case. What makes you so interested?" "It was a big case here at the time. I heard some blue suitors talking about it. Pulled up what I could on the box, and got interested. It looked like with this task force thing, you weren't doing much with it at the moment. And you want to give it a shot?" "I make no promises, but yeah, I'd like to do some work on it. I would keep you in the loop. Still your case. I'd just do some street work." Ballard was on the freeway, but not moving. Her weeding through the boxes in the storage room had pushed her into the heart of rush hour. She knew the morning breeze would also be in full effect on the coast. She'd be paddling against it, and the chop it would kick up. She was missing her window. "It's 9 years later," Soto said. I'm not sure the street's going to produce anything, especially on Graveyard. You'll be spinning your wheels.
Well, maybe, Ballard said.
But they're my wheels to spin. You okay with this or not? There was another long pause. Enough time for Ballard to move the van about 5 feet.
There's something you should know, Soto said. There's somebody else looking into it. Somebody outside the department.
Oh, yeah? Ballard said.
Who's that?
My old partner. His name's Harry Bosch. He's retired now, but he needs the work.
One of those, huh?
Okay. Anything else I should know? Was this one of his cases?
No, but he knows the victim's mother. He's doing it for her, like a dog with a bone.
Good to know. Ballard was now getting a better sense of the lay of the land. It was the true purpose of her call. Permission to work the case was the least of her concerns.
If I come up with anything, I'll feed it to you, Ballard said, and I'll let you get back to the reckoning.
Ballard thought she heard a muffled laugh.
Hey, Ballard, Soto then added quietly. I said I knew who you were. I also know who Olivas is. I mean, I work with him. I want you to know I appreciate what you did, and I know you paid a price. I just wanted to say that.
Ballard nodded to herself.
That's good to know, she said. I'll be in touch.
Bosch. Chapter 5. From the San Fernando courthouse, it was only a block's walk back to the old jail where Bosch did his file work. He covered the distance quickly, a spring in his step caused by the search warrant in his hand. Judge Atticus Finch Landry had read it in chambers and asked Bosch a few perfunctory questions before signing the approval page. Bosch now had the authority to execute the search and hopefully find the bullet that would lead to an arrest and the closing of another case. He took the shortcut through the city's public works yard to the back door of the old jail. He pulled the key to the padlock as he moved toward the former drunk tank, where the open case files were kept on steel shelves. He found that he had left the lock open and silently chastised himself. It was a breach of his own, as well as departmental protocol. The files were to be kept locked up at all times, and Bosch liked to keep the matters on his desk secure, too, even during a 40-minute search warrant run to the courthouse next door. He moved behind his makeshift desk, an old wooden door set across two stacks of file boxes, and sat down. Immediately he saw the twisted paperclip sitting on top of his closed laptop. He stared at it. He had not put it there. "You forgot that?" Bosch looked up. The woman, the detective from the night before at Hollywood Station, was straddling the old bench that ran between the freestanding shelves full of case files. She had been out of his line of sight as he came into the cell. He looked over at the open door where the padlock dangled from its chain. "Ballard, right?" he said. "Good to know I'm not going crazy. I thought I had locked up." "I let myself in," Ballard said. "Lockpicking 101. It's a good skill to have. Meantime, I'm kind of busy here. Just got a search warrant I need to figure out how to execute without my suspect finding out. What do you want, Detective Ballard?"
"I want in."
"In?"
"On Daisy Clayton."
Bosch considered her for a moment. She was attractive, maybe mid-30s, with brown sun-streaked hair, cut at the shoulders, and a slim athletic build. She was wearing off-duty clothes. The night before, she had been in work clothes that made her seem more formidable. A must in the LAPD, where Bosch knew female detectives were often treated like office secretaries. Ballard also had a deep tan, which to Bosch was at odds with the idea of someone who worked the graveyard shift. Most of all, he was impressed that it had been only 12 hours since she had surprised him at the file cabinets in the Hollywood Detective Bureau, and she already appeared to have caught up to him and what he was doing. "I talked to your old partner, Lucy," Ballard said. "She gave me her blessing. It is a Hollywood Station case, after all."
"Was, till RHD took it," Bosch said. "They have standing now, not Hollywood."
"And what's your standing? You're out of the LAPD.
Doesn't seem to be any link to the town of San Fernando that I could see in the book. In his capacity as an SFPD reserve officer for the past 3 years, Bosch had largely been working on a backlog of cold cases of all kinds. Murders, rapes, assaults. But the work was part-time. They give me a lot of freedom up here, Bosch said. I work these cases and I also work my own. Daisy Clayton's one of my own. You could say I have a vested interest. That's my standing. And I have 12 boxes of shake cards at Hollywood Station, Ballard said. Bosch nodded. He was even more impressed. She had somehow figured out exactly what he had gone to Hollywood for. As he studied her, he decided it wasn't all a tan. She had a mix of races in her skin. He guessed that she was probably half white, half Polynesian. I figure the two of us, we could get through them in a couple nights, Ballard said. There was the offer. She wanted in and would give Bosch what he was looking for in trade. The shake cards are a long shot, he said. Truth is, I've run the string out on the case. I was hoping there might be something in the cards. That's surprising, Ballard said. I heard you're the kind of guy who never lets the string run out. Your old partner called you a dog with a bone. Bosch didn't know what to say to that. He shrugged. Ballard got up and walked toward him down the aisle between the shelves. Sometimes it's slow, sometimes it isn't, she said. I'm going to start looking through the cards tonight, between calls. Anything in particular I should look for? Bosch paused, but knew he needed to make a decision. Trust her, or keep her on the outside. Vans, he said. Look for work vans, guys who carry chemicals, maybe. For transporting her, she said. For the whole thing. It said in the book the guy took her home or to a motel, someplace with a bathtub, for the bleaching. Bosch shook his head. No, he didn't use a bathtub, he said. She stared at him, waiting, not asking the obvious question of how he knew. All right, come with me, he finally said. He got up and led her out of the cell, and back to the door to the public works yard. You looked at the book and the photos, right? He said. Yes, she said. Everything that was digitized. They walked into the yard, which was a large open-air square surrounded by walls. Along the back wall, there were four bays, delineated by tool racks and workbenches where city equipment and vehicles were maintained and repaired. Bosch led Ballard into one of these. You saw the mark on the body? The ASP? Right. But they got the meaning of it wrong, the original detectives. They went down a spiral with it, and it was all wrong. He went to a workbench and reached up to a shelf where there was a large translucent plastic tub with a blue snap on top. He brought it down and held it out to her. 25-gallon container, Bosch said. Daisy was 5'2", 105 pounds. Small. He put her in one of these, then put in the bleach as needed. He didn't use a bathtub. Ballard studied the container. Bosch's explanation was plausible, but not conclusive. That's a theory, she said. No theory, he said. He put the container down on the floor so he could unsnap the top. He then lifted the tub up and angled it so she could see into it. He reached inside and pointed to a manufacturer's seal stamped into the plastic at the bottom. It was a 2-inch circle, with the ASP reading horizontally and vertically in the center. ASP, he said. American Storage Products, or American Soft Plastics. Same company, two names. The killer put her in one of these. He didn't need a bathtub or a motel. One of these in a van. Ballard reached into the container and ran a finger over the manufacturer's seal. Bosch knew she was drawing the same conclusion he had. The logo was stamped into the plastic on the underside of the tub, creating a ridged impression on the inside. If Daisy's skin had been pressed against the ridges, the logo would have left its mark. Ballard pulled her arm out and looked up from the tub to Bosch. How'd you figure this out? She asked. I thought like he did, Bosch said. Let me guess. These are untraceable? They make them in Gardena, ship them to retailers everywhere. They do some direct sales to commercial accounts, but as far as individual sales go, forget it. You can get these at every Target and Walmart in the country. Well, shit.
Yeah. Bosch snapped the top back on the tub and was about to return it to the high shelf. Can I take it? Ballard asked. Bosch turned to her. He knew he could replace it and that she could easily get her own. He guessed it was a move to draw him further into a partnership. If he gave her something, then it meant they were working together. He handed the tub over. It's yours, he said. Thank you, she said. She looked at the open gate to the public works yard. Okay, so I start tonight on the shakes, she said. Bosch nodded. Where were they, he asked. In storage, Ballard said. Nobody wanted to throw them out. I figured. It was smart. What were you going to do if you found them still in the file cabinets? I don't know. Probably ask Money if I could hang around and look through them. Were you just going to look at cards from the day or week of the murder? The month, maybe? No. All of them. Whatever they still had. Who's to say the guy who did this didn't get FI'd a couple years before or a year after? Ballard nodded. No stone uncovered. I get it. That'd make you change your mind? It'll be a lot of work. Nope. Good. Well, I'm gonna go. Might even go in early to get started. Happy hunting. If I can come by, I will. But I have a search warrant to execute. Right. Otherwise, call me if you find something. He reached into a pocket and produced a business card with his cell number on it. Copy that, she said. Ballard walked off, holding the container in front of her, by the indented grips on either side. As Bosch watched, she made a smooth U-turn and came back to him. Lucy Soto said you know Daisy's mother, she said. Is that the standing you said you had?
I guess you could say that, Bosch said.
Where's the mother if I want to talk to her?
My house. You can talk to her anytime.
You live with her?
She's staying with me. It's temporary. 8620 Woodrow Wilson.
Okay, got it. Ballard turned again and walked off.
Bosch watched her go. She made no further U-turns.
Chapter 6 Bosch went back into the jail to get the search warrant and to close and lock the cold case cell. He then crossed First Street and entered the SFPD Detective Bureau through the side door off the parking lot. He saw two of the unit's full-time detectives at their workstations. Bella Lourdes was a senior detective, most often paired with Bosch when his investigations took him out into the streets. She had a soft, motherly look that camouflaged her skills and toughness. Oscar Luzon was older than Lourdes, but the most recent transfer to the detective unit. He had a sedentary thickness settling in and liked wearing his badge on a chain around his neck, like a narc instead of on his belt. Otherwise, it might not be seen. Danny Sisto, the third member of the team, was not present. Bosch checked Captain Trevino's office and found the door open and the detective commander behind his desk. He looked up from some paperwork at Bosch.
How'd it go? Trevino asked.
Signed, sealed, delivered, Bosch said, holding the warrant up as proof. You want to get everybody in the war room to talk about how we do this?
Yeah, bring Bella and Oscar in.
Sisto's out at a crime scene, so he won't make it. I'll pull somebody in from patrol.
What about LAPD?
Let's figure it out first, and then I'll call Foothill and make it a captain-to-captain thing. Trevino was picking up the phone to call the watch office as he spoke. Bosch ducked back out and used the warrant to signal Lourdes and Luzon to the war room. Bosch went in, took a yellow pad off the supply table, and sat at one end of the oval meeting table. The so-called war room was really a multi-purpose room. It was used for training classes, as a lunchroom, as an emergency command post, and on occasion, as a place to strategize investigations and tactics with the whole detective squad, all five members of it. Bosch sat down and flipped over the cover sheet of the warrant so he could reread the probable cause section he had composed. It was drawn from a 14-year-old murder case. The victim was Cristobal Vega, 52, who was shot once in the back of the head while he was walking his dog up his street to Pioneer Park. Vega was a veteran gang member, a shot caller for Vario Sanfer 13, one of the oldest and most violent gangs in the San Fernando Valley. His death was a shock to the tiny town of San Fernando, because he was well known within the community after having publicly adopted a godfather-like presence, deciding neighborhood disputes, contributing major funds to local churches and schools, and even delivering food baskets to the needy during the holidays. It was a good guy disguise that cloaked a 30-plus year run as a gangster. On the inside of the VSF, he was notoriously violent and known by the moniker Uncle Murda. He moved with two bodyguards at all times and rarely strayed from Sanford Turf because he had been greenlit by all surrounding gangs as a result of his leadership position and planning of violent forays into other turf. The Vineland boys wanted him dead. The Pacas wanted him dead. Pacoima Flats wanted him dead. And so on. The killing of Uncle Murder was also surprising because Vega had been caught on the street alone. He had a handgun tucked into the waist of his sweatpants, but had apparently thought he was safe to duck out of his fortified home and take his dog to the park shortly after dawn. He never made it. He was found face down on the sidewalk, a block short of the park. His assassin had approached so stealthily from behind that Vega had not even pulled the gun from his waistband. Though Vega was a hood and a killer himself, the SFPD investigation into his murder had initially been intense. But no witness to the shooting was ever found, and the only evidence recovered was a .38 bullet removed during autopsy from the victim's brain. No competing gang from the area took credit for the kill, and graffiti that either lamented or celebrated Vega's demise offered no clue as to who or what gang had carried out the hit. The case went cold, and detectives who were assigned due diligence checks on it each year did not muster a lot of enthusiasm. It was clearly a case where the victim's death was not seen as much of a loss to society. The world was doing just fine without Uncle Murda. But when Bosch opened the files as part of his cold case review, he took a different approach. He had always operated according to the axiom that everybody counts in this world, or nobody counts. This belief dictated that he must give each case and each victim his best effort. The fact that Uncle Murder had gotten his moniker because of his willingness to carry out the deadly business of the VSF did not deter Bosch from wanting to find his killer. In Bosch's book, nobody should be able to come up behind a man on a sidewalk at dawn, put a bullet in his brain, and then disappear into the shadows of time. There was a murderer out there. He might have killed since, and he might kill again. Bosch was coming for him. The time of death was determined by various factors. Vega's wife said he had gotten up at 6 a.m. and taken the dog out the door about 20 minutes later. The coroner could only narrow it down to the 100 minutes between then and 8 a.m., which was when his body was discovered by a resident near the park. Two canvasses by detectives in the neighborhood produced not a single resident who reported hearing the shot, leading to the conclusion that the shooter might have used a silencer on his weapon, or the entire neighborhood did not want to cooperate with police. While there were many handicaps in the investigation of year-old cases, loss of evidence, witnesses, crime scenes, the element of time could also be advantageous. Bosch always looked for ways to turn time in his favor. In the Cristobal Vega investigation, a lot had happened in the 14 years since the murder. Many of the gangsters in the VSF and its rivals had gone to prison for various crimes, including murder. Some had gone straight and cut ties with the life. These were the people Bosch focused on, using database searches and conversations with gang unit officers in the SFPD and from nearby LAPD divisions to produce two lists of gangsters in prison or believed to be in the straight life. Over the previous year, he had made numerous prison stops and conducted dozens of visits to the homes and workplaces of men who had left their gang affiliations behind. Each conversation was tailored to the circumstances of the man he was visiting, but in each instance, questioning casually moved toward the unsolved killing of Cristobal Vega. Most of the conversations were dead ends. The subject either maintained the code of silence or had no knowledge of the Vega killing. But eventually, pieces of information started to create the mosaic. When he heard more than three denials of involvement from members of the same gang, he moved that gang off the suspect list. Eventually, he had scratched every one of the Sanfer rivals off the list. It wasn't conclusive, but it was enough to turn his focus inward at Vega's own gang. Bosch eventually struck pay dirt in the rear parking lot of a discount shoe store in Alhambra, east of Los Angeles. The store was where a man named Martin Perez, a reformed sanfer, worked as an inventory manager far away from the turf he once trod. Perez was 41 years old and had shed his gang affiliation 12 years earlier. Though he had been carried in gang unit intel files as a hardcore member of the Sanfers since he was 16, he had escaped a life with several arrests on his record, but no convictions. He had never been to prison and had spent only a few days here and there in county jail. The files Bosch reviewed contained color photos of the tattoos that adorned most parts of Perez's body during his active years. Included in these was an RIP Uncle Murder ink job on his neck. This put him high on the list of men Bosch wanted to talk to. Bosch staked out the shoe store's parking lot and spotted Perez stepping out back to smoke a cigarette while on a 3 p.m. break. Through a pair of binoculars, Bosch confirmed that Perez still carried the tattoo on his neck. He noted the time of the break and then drove away. The next day he came back shortly before break time. He was dressed in blue jeans and a denim work shirt with permanent stains on it and carried a soft pack of Marlboro Reds in the breast pocket. When he saw Perez behind the shop, he casually joined him, holding a cigarette up and asking if he could borrow a light. Perez flicked a lighter, and Bosch leaned in to ignite his smoke. Leaning back away, Bosch mentioned the tattoo he had just seen up close and asked how Uncle Murda died. Perez responded by saying that Uncle Murda was a good man who had been set up by his own people. "How come?" Bosch asked.
"Because he got greedy," Perez said.
Bosch pushed no further. He finished his cigarette, the first he had smoked in years, and thanked Perez for the light, then walked away. That night, Bosch knocked on the door of Perez's apartment. He was accompanied by Bella Lourdes. This time he identified himself, as did Lourdes, and told Perez he had a problem. He pulled his phone and played a snippet of the conversation they had shared while smoking behind the shoe store. Bosch explained that Perez had knowledge about a gang murder, but had deliberately withheld it from authorities. This was obstruction of justice, a crime, not to mention conspiracy to commit murder, which would be the charges he would face unless he agreed to cooperate. Perez took the option of cooperating, but he did not want to go to the San Fernando Police Department, lest he be spotted in the old neighborhood by someone he used to run with. Bosch made a call to an old friend who worked in the Sheriff's Department Homicide Unit in Whittier and arranged to borrow an interview room for a couple hours. The threat of charges against Perez was largely a bluff by Bosch, but it worked. Perez was deathly afraid of the L.A. County Jail and the California prison system. He said both were well-stocked with members of the M.A., the Mexican Mafia, which had a strong alliance with the VSF and was known for its brutal crimes against those who snitched or were perceived to be vulnerable to law enforcement pressure to flip. Perez believed that he would be marked for death whether he snitched or not. He chose to put everything on the table in hopes of convincing Bosch and Lourdes that he was not the killer, but knew who was. The story Perez told was as old as the crime of murder itself. Vega had risen to a place of power in the gang, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. He was taking more than his share in proceeds from the Sanfer's criminal enterprises, and was also known to force sexual relations on young women associated with members on the lower tiers of the gang. Many of those young vatos despised him. One named Tranquilo Cortez plotted against him. According to Perez, he was the nephew of Vega's wife and was incensed by Vega's greed and very public infidelities. Perez was in Cortez's clique, within the gang, and was privy to part of the planning, but insisted he was not present when Cortez killed Vega. The case had long been considered the perfect hit within the SFPD, because no evidence other than a bullet had been left behind. So this was where Bosch and Lourdes pressed Perez, asking many questions about the gun, its ownership, and its present whereabouts. Perez said the gun was Cortez's own gun, but had no information on how Cortez came to own it. As far as what happened to the weapon after the murder, he had no idea, because he soon separated himself from the gang and left the valley. But Perez did provide a piece of information that gave Bosch his focus. He said that Cortez had equipped the gun with a homemade silencer. This fit with the original investigation. Bosch zeroed in, asking how Cortez had made the silencer. Perez said that at the time, Cortez worked in an uncle's muffler shop in nearby Pacoima, and he had machined it out of the same piping and internal sound-suppressing materials used in motorcycle mufflers. He did this after hours and without his uncle's knowledge. Perez also acknowledged that he and two other fellow gang members were with Cortez in the shop when he tested his creation by attaching it to his gun and firing a couple of shots into the back wall of the muffler shop. After the interview with Perez, the priority for the investigators became confirming as much of his story as possible. Lourdes was able to nail down the link between Cortez and Vega's wife. She was his father's sister. She also determined that Cortez's standing within the VSF had risen over the past 14 years, and he was now a shot caller, like the man he was suspected of assassinating. Meanwhile, Bosch confirmed that Pacoima Tire and Muffler, located on San Fernando Road in Los Angeles, was previously owned by Helio Cortez, the suspect's uncle, and that the new owner's name was not in any gang intel files of the San Fernando and Los Angeles police departments. Other details were substantiated, and it all added up to enough probable cause for Bosch to go see a judge for a search warrant. He had that now, and it was time to move the case forward. Lourdes and Luzon were the first to enter the war room. Soon they were followed by Trevino, and then Sergeant Irwin Rosenberg, a dayside watch commander. In accordance with department protocol, all search warrants were served with a uniformed presence, and Rosenberg, a veteran street cop with high people skills, would coordinate that side of things. Everyone took seats around the oval table.
"What, no donuts?" Rosenberg asked.
The table was usually where the spread of food donated by citizens ended up. Almost every morning there were donuts or breakfast burritos. Rosenberg's disappointment was shared by all.
"All right, let's get this going," Trevino said. "What have we got, Harry? You should bring Irwin up to speed."
"This is the Cristobal Vega case," Bosch said. "The murder of Uncle Murda 14 years ago. We have a search warrant allowing us to enter Pacoima Tire and Muffler on San Fernando Road and search for bullets fired into the rear wall of the main garage 14 years ago. This place is on LAPD turf, so we will coordinate with them. We want to do it as unobtrusively as possible so word doesn't get back to our suspect or anybody else with the Sanfers. We want to keep this quiet until it's time to hopefully make an arrest."
"It's going to be impossible with the Sanfers," Rosenberg said. "They have eyes all over the place."
Bosch nodded. "We know that," he said. "Bella's been working on a cover story. We just need to buy a couple days. If we find slugs, then I have it greased down at the lab. They'll ASAP the comparison to the bullet that killed Vega. If there's a match, we'll be good to go at our suspect."
"Who is the suspect?" Rosenberg asked.
Bosch hesitated. He trusted Rosenberg, but it was not good case management to discuss suspects, especially when there was an informant involved.
"Never mind," Rosenberg said quickly. "I don't need to know. So do you want to keep this to one car, two uniforms?"
"At the most," Bosch said.
"Done. We've got the new SUV in the yard that just came in. Hasn't been decaled yet. We could use that. Not advertise we're from SFPD. That might help."
Bosch nodded. He had seen the SUV in the public works yard by the old jail. It had arrived from the manufacturer in black and white paint, but the SFPD identifiers had not been applied to its doors and rear hatch. It could blend in with the LAPD vehicles and help disguise that the search was part of an SFPD investigation. It would further insulate the investigation from the VSF.
"In case we have to take out the whole wall, we'll have a public works crew with us," Bosch said. "They'll be using an unmarked truck."
"So what's our cover?" Luzon asked.
"Burglary," Lourdes said. "If anybody asks, we say somebody broke in during the night and there's a crime scene. It should do it. The place is no longer owned by the suspect's uncle. As far as we can tell, the new owner is clean, and we expect his full cooperation with both the search and the cover story."
"Good," Trevino said. "When do we go?"
"Tomorrow morning," Bosch said. "Right when the place opens at 7. With any luck, we'll be in and out before most gangsters in the neighborhood open their eyes for the day.
Okay, Trevino said. Let's rally here at 6 and be in Pacoima when they open the doors.
The meeting broke up after that, and Bosch followed Lourdes back to her workstation.
Hey, I had a visitor to my cell earlier, he said.
Did you send her over?
Lourdes shook her head.
No, nobody came in here, she said. I've been doing reports all day.
Bosch nodded. He wondered about Ballard and how she knew where to find him. His guess was that Lucia Soto had told her. He knew he would find out soon enough.
Chapter 7 Bosch got home early. He smelled cooking as soon as he opened the door, and found Elizabeth Clayton in the kitchen. She was sautéing chicken in butter and garlic.
Hey, Bosch said. Smells good.
I wanted to make you something, she said. They awkwardly hugged while she was in front of the stove. When Bosch first met her, she was an addict trying to bury her daughter's murder under a mountain of pills. She had had a shaved head, weighed 90 pounds, and would have willingly traded sex for 30 milligrams of guilt and memory-blurring oxycodone. 7 months later, she was clean and had put on 20 pounds, and her sandy blonde hair was long enough to frame the pretty face that had emerged during recovery. But the guilt and memories were still there, at the edge of darkness, and threatening every day.
That's great, he said. I'm going to clean up first, okay?
It'll be a half hour, she said. I have to boil the noodles.
Bosch walked down the hallway, past Elizabeth's room, and into his own. He took off his work clothes and got into the shower. As the water cascaded down on his head, he thought about cases and victims. The woman cooking his dinner was a victim of the fallout that comes from murder, her daughter taken in a way too horrible to contemplate. Bosch thought he had rescued Elizabeth the year before. He had helped her through addiction, and now she was straight and healthy. But the addiction had been what buffered reality and kept that contemplation away. He had promised her he would solve her daughter's killing, but now found that he could not talk to her about the case without causing her the kind of pain she used to vanquish with pills. He was left with the question of whether he had rescued her at all. After showering, he shaved, because he knew it might be a couple days before he got the next chance. He was finishing up when he heard Elizabeth call him to dinner. In the months since Elizabeth had moved in, Bosch had returned the dining room to its rightful purpose. He had moved his laptop and the files from the cases he was working into his bedroom, where he had a folding table set up. He didn't think she should be constantly reminded of murder, especially when he wasn't around. She had place settings across from each other at the table, and the food on another plate between them. She served him. There were 2 glasses of water. No alcohol.
Looks great, Bosch said.
Well, let's hope it tastes great, she said. They ate silently for a few minutes, and Bosch complimented her. The chicken had a good garlic kick that tasted great going down. He knew it would kick back later on, but didn't mention that.
How was group? He asked.
Mark Twain dropped out, she said. She always referred to others in her daily group therapy meetings by code names drawn from famous people they reminded her of. Mark Twain had white hair and a bushy mustache. There was a Cher, an Albert, as in Einstein, an O.J., a Lady Gaga, and a Gandhi, who was also referred to as Ben, as in Ben Kingsley, the actor who won an Oscar for portraying him.
Permanently? Bosch asked.
Looks like it, she said. He had a slip and went back into lockdown.
That's too bad.
Yeah, I liked hearing his stories. They were funny.
More silence passed between them. Bosch tried to think of something to say or ask. The awkwardness of the relationship had grown to be the main part of it. Bosch had long known that inviting her to use a room in his house had been a mistake. He wasn't sure what he had thought would come of it. Elizabeth reminded Bosch of his former wife, Eleanor, but that was only a physical resemblance. Elizabeth Clayton was a badly damaged person with dark memories to work through and a difficult path ahead. It had only been a temporary invitation, an until-you-get-on-your-feet thing. Bosch had converted a large storage room off the hallway into a small bedroom and furnished it with purchases from IKEA.
but it had been almost 6 months, and Bosch was unsure that Elizabeth would or could ever stand on her feet alone again. The call of her addiction was always there. The memory of her daughter was like a malignant ghost that followed her, and she had nowhere to go, except maybe back up to Modesto, where she had lived until her world fell apart with a midnight call from the LAPD. Meantime, Bosch had alienated his daughter, who had not been consulted before he extended the invitation. She was away at college and came home less and less already, but the addition of Elizabeth Clayton to the household served to stop all visitation. Now Bosch saw Maddie only when he ventured down to Orange County to grab a quick breakfast or late dinner with her. On the last visit, she had announced that she planned to stay the summer in the house she rented with three other students near campus. Bosch took the news as a direct reaction to having Elizabeth in his house. "I have to work tonight," Bosch said.
"I thought you said you had that search warrant thing tomorrow morning," Elizabeth said.
"I do, but this is something else. It's about Daisy." He said nothing further until he could gauge her response. A few moments went by, and she didn't try to change the subject. "There's a Hollywood detective who's interested in the case," he said. "She came to me today and asked questions. She's on the late show and is going to work it when she has time."
"The late show?" Elizabeth asked.
"That's what they call the midnight shift at Hollywood Division, because of all the crazy stuff that happens there in the middle of the night. Anyway, she found some old records I'd been looking for. Cards where patrol officers took names of people on the street, people they stopped or were suspicious of."
"Was Daisy one of them?"
"Probably, but that's not why I want to see them. I want to see who else was floating around Hollywood at that time. It could lead to something."
"Okay."
"Anyway, there are 12 boxes of them. We'll do what we can tonight, and then I have the search warrant in the morning. It could be a couple nights going down there."
"Okay. I hope you find something."
"The detective, her name is Ballard, asked about you. She said she might want to meet with you. Would that be okay?"
"Of course. I don't really know anything that can help, but I will talk to anybody about Daisy."
Bosch nodded. It had been more than they said about the case in weeks, and he worried it would send Elizabeth into a dark spiral of depression if he pushed it further. He checked his watch. It wasn't quite 8 o'clock. "I might take a nap for a couple of hours before I head down there," he said. "That okay?"
"Yes, you should," she said. "I'll clean all this up and try to be quiet."
"Don't worry about it. I doubt I'll sleep. I'll just rest." 15 minutes later, Bosch was on his back, looking up at the ceiling in his bedroom. He could hear the water running in the kitchen and the dishes being stacked in the rack next to the sink. He had set an alarm, but knew he wouldn't be able to sleep.
Ballard. Chapter 8. Ballard got to Hollywood Division 3 hours before her 11 p.m. shift started, so she could begin work on the shake cards. She first entered the main station, grabbed the late show Rover out of its charger, and took it with her back across the parking lot to the outbuilding, where she had left the boxes lined in the hallway. There was nobody in the gym or martial arts training room. She found a workspace in one of the storage rooms where wooden desks predating the last renovation of the station were still stored. Despite what Bosch had said earlier, Ballard was tempted to go right to the box of field interview cards from the time of the Daisy Clayton murder. Maybe she would get lucky, and an obvious suspect would emerge from a 3x5 card. But she knew that Bosch's plan was the right one. To be thorough, she should start at the beginning and move chronologically forward. The first box of shake cards had dates beginning in January 2006, fully 3 years before the Clayton murder. She put the box on the floor next to the desk she was using and started pulling out 4-inch stacks at a time. She gave each card a quick glance, front and back, focusing on the location and time of the stop, checking to see if the interviewee was a male, and then examining the details further if warranted. It took her 2 hours to get through the first box. Out of all the cards she examined, she put aside 3 for follow-up and discussion with Bosch, and just 1 for herself. In the process, she reaffirmed her long-held belief about Hollywood being a final destination for many of society's freaks and losers. Card after card contained records of interviews with individuals who were aimlessly roaming the streets, looking for whatever grim opportunity presented itself. Many were outsiders, trying to buy drugs or sex, and the police stop was designed to dissuade them. Others were permanent denizens, whether predators or prey, of the Hollywood streets, with no seeming plan to change their situation. Along the way, Ballard got to know something about the cops who conducted the field interviews. Some were verbose, some were profoundly grammatically challenged. Some used codes, like Adam Henry, asshole, to describe the citizens they were interviewing. Some obviously didn't care to write FI cards and kept things to a minimum. Some were able to keep their sense of humor, despite the circumstances of their job and the view it gave them of humanity. The blank side of the card was where the most telling information was found, and Ballard read these many reports with an almost anthropological interest for what they said about Hollywood and society at large. She put one card aside for herself, simply because she liked what the officer had written. Subject is a human tumbleweed. Goes where the wind blows him. Will blow away tomorrow. Nobody will miss him. The officer was named on the cards as T. Farmer. Ballard found herself looking for his FI cards so she could read more of his elegiac street reports. The three cards she set aside for follow-up were all for white males who were deemed tourists by the officers who made the stop. This meant they were outsiders who came into Hollywood to look for something. In the case of these three men, most likely sex. They had not committed any crime when stopped and interviewed, so the officers were circumspect in what they wrote. But it was clear from the location, time, and tenor of the interviews that the officers suspected the men were trolling for prostitutes. One man was on foot, one man was in a car, and the third was in what was described as a work van. Ballard would run their names and license plates through the computer and law enforcement databases to see if there was any record or activity that warranted a closer look. Ballard was halfway through the second box when her rover squawked at exactly midnight. It was Lieutenant Monroe.
"I missed you at roll call, Ballard."
She was not required to attend roll call, but she appeared so often that it was noticed when she didn't.
"Sorry about that. I'm working on something and I lost track of time. Anything I should know?"
"No, all quiet. But your boyfriend from last night is here. Should I send him back?"
Ballard paused before keying the mic and answering. She assumed her visitor was Bosch. She knew that complaining about Monroe calling him her boyfriend would be a complete waste of time and would cost her more than she would gain from it. She keyed the mic.
"I'm not in detectives. Hold my boyfriend there. I'll come get him."
"Roger that."
"Hey, LT, we have a PO on Hollywood roster named T. Farmer." If Farmer was still in the division, he must work dayside now. She knew everybody on the night shifts. It was a few moments before Monroe responded.
"Not anymore. He went EOW right before you got here."
End of watch. Ballard suddenly remembered that when she was reassigned to Hollywood 3 years earlier, the whole division was mourning the death of one of its officers. It had been a suicide. She now realized it had been Farmer. Ballard felt an invisible punch to the chest. She keyed the mic. "Copy that." Chapter 9. Ballard decided to keep the review of the field interview cards close to the source. She brought Bosch to the storage room and set him up at one of the old desks, where it was less likely that other Hollywood officers would see him working with her and raise questions about it. She called Lieutenant Monroe on the private watch office number and told him where she would be if needed. Bosch and Ballard decided to split reading duties,
rather than have Bosch back read the cards Ballard had already gone through. It was the first sign of trust between them, a belief that each could rely on the other's assessment of the cards, and it would make the process faster. Ballard was at a desk positioned perpendicular to Bosch's, and this allowed her to watch him head on, while he would have to turn and be more obvious about attempting to observe her. At first, she surreptitiously kept an eye on him, and in doing so ascertained that his process was different. His rate of putting cards aside for further consideration was far quicker than hers. At some point, he noticed that she was watching him. "Don't worry," he said, without looking up from his work. "I'm employing a two-step approach. First, a big net, then a smaller net." Ballard just nodded, a bit embarrassed that she had been caught. She soon started her own two-step process and stopped paying attention to Bosch, realizing that she was only slowing her own work down by watching him. After a long stretch of silence, and after putting a large stack of cards into the no-interest pile, Ballard spoke. "Can I ask you something?" she began.
"What if I said no?" Bosch replied. "You'd ask anyway."
"How did Daisy's mother end up living in your house?"
"It's a long story, but she needed a place to stay. I had a room."
"So this is not a romantic thing?"
"No."
"But you let this stranger stay in your house?"
"Sort of. I met her on an unrelated case. I helped her out of a jam, and then I found out about Daisy. I told her I'd look into the case, and she could use the room I had while I investigated. She's from Modesto. I assume that if we close this thing, I'll get my room back, and she'll go home."
"You couldn't do that if you were with the LAPD."
"There's a lot I couldn't do if I were still with the LAPD. But I'm not."
They both went back to the cards, but almost immediately Ballard spoke again. "I still want to talk to her," she said.
"I told her that," Bosch said. "Anytime you like."
A half hour went by, and they both managed to finish off the cards in their respective boxes. Bosch went out into the hallway and brought a fresh box in for Ballard, and then repeated the process for himself. "How long can you do this?" Ballard asked.
"You mean tonight?" Bosch asked. "Till about 5:30. I have a thing at 6 up in the valley. It may run through most of the day. If it does, I'll be back tomorrow night."
"When do you sleep?"
"When I can."
They were 10 minutes into their next boxes when Ballard's radio squawked. Ballard responded, and Monroe told her that a detective was requested on the burglary of an occupied dwelling on Sunset Boulevard. Ballard looked at the stack of FI cards in front of her and radioed back.
"You sure they need a detective, LT?" "They asked,"